This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. And this week, Catherine Druckman and I talk with Holmes Wilson of a new collaborative team chat system that's pure peer-to-peer, end-to-end, no servers required, collaboration system called Quiet. It's really great. It's at 0.5 right now, but it's on GitHub. You can work with it. You can join in. It's an awesome thing, and it has so many implications. It's huge. You can get past Slack, get past Discord, lots of other things. But that's coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 682, recorded Wednesday, May 25th, 2022. Free and open P2P team chat with Quiet. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit KOLIDE.com/floss to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. And by New Relic. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Get New Relic before it does, and you can get access to the whole New Relic platform and 100 gigabytes of data free per month forever. No credit card required. Sign up at newrelic.com/floss. Hello again, everybody, wherever you are, whatever time it is. I am Doc Searles, and this is Floss Weekly. And I'm joined this week by Catherine Druckman herself, who may appear on screen. There she is. And this is, for us, a little bit of repeat, but we're not going to repeat ourselves, in that our guest today is Holmes Wilson of Quiet, which is unlike most things we've done, brand new. It's not like it's got a big commercial thing that's or something that everybody can use. It's something that's in the works. So, and you're in Texas. I think we just like to establish where we are.
I am in Houston, Texas. Very warm. I'm here. Pretty excited about this conversation.
Yeah, I know. There was more to talk about after we.
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah, I don't feel like we finished. There's so much more.
Yeah, on another podcast of our own that used to be the Linux Journal podcast called Reality 2. And we had Holmes on there, and it was a good show. So we know this one will be too. So what are you looking to hit on this time that we didn't last time, Catherine, in case we forget?
Oh, gosh, there's so much. You know, I kind of want to talk about the big picture of, you know, why this is so important. And you mentioned earlier that this is, did you say the fourth anniversary of the GDPR?
Of the enforceability of the GDPR. Yeah, it became enforceable on May 25th.
I remember the day very well, actually.
2018, and we all rejoiced, and it hasn't been especially enforced since then. So everywhere.
It's the times like that when you really kind of reflect on why we take care with things like our digital privacy and why we seek out projects like Quiet that we're going to talk about, because, you know, they serve a purpose, and we'll, you know, of course get to more of that, but that's among the reasons I'm excited to have the conversation today.
Cool. So before we jump into that, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a new take on endpoint management that asks the question, how can we get end users more involved? This is in contrast to old school device management tools like MDM, which lock down your employees' devices without considering their needs or even attempting to educate them about the security of their laptop. Collide is built by like-minded security practitioners who in the past saw just how much MDM was disrupting their end users, often frustrating them so much that they would throw their hands up and just switch to using their personal laptops without telling anyone. In that scenario, everyone loses. Collide, on the other hand, is different. Instead of locking down a device, Collide takes a user-focused approach that communicates security recommendations directly to your employees on Slack. After Collide is set up, device security turns from a black and white state into a dynamic conversation. The conversation starts with the end users installing the endpoint agent on their own through a guided process that happens right inside their first Slack message. From there, Collide regularly sends employees recommendations when their device is in an insecure state. This can range from simple problems like the screen lock not being set correctly to hard to solve and nuanced issues like asking people to secure two-factor backup code sitting in their downloads folder properly. And because it's talking directly to employees, Collide is educating them about the company's policies and how to best keep their devices secure using real tangible examples, not theoretical scenarios. Collide, cross-platform endpoint management for Linux, Mac, and Windows devices that puts end users first, for teams that Slack. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. Visit KOLIDE.com/floss today. And right now, you can get a goodie bag of Collide swag after signing up for a new trial as their way of saying thank you. Okay, so our guest this morning is Holmes Wilson. And I met Holmes through a common affiliation we have. He's an affiliate of the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard, and I'm an alumnus fellow there, and it's a great institution. And I still run a project there, which is to say they let me use the server, but it's a great one. We have a mailing list there, and Holmes mentioned Quiet on there, this thing he's working on, and it looked terribly interesting to me. So we're all over that case. And so Holmes, there you are. For those of you who are not visually impaired, here he appears. How you doing, man?
Hi, I'm doing great. Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you. And you're in Worcester, Mass, and just a little bit west of where I used to live, around Cambridge. So I didn't mention that that Holmes is a co-founder of Fight for the Future, which is one of my favorite organizations and something that I think is an essential thing. So tell us a little bit about that and how you got from that to where you are with Quiet, because I'm sure there's a connection.
Cool. Yeah. Well, so for folks who haven't heard of it, Fight for the Future is an activism organization that works primarily in the United States on issues that face the internet, political issues that face the internet. So Fight for the Future is best known for the work that it did on SOPA PIPA in 2011, 2012, when there were two bills in Congress that seemed almost guaranteed to pass that would have been disastrous for the internet, that would have held any website or any website owner responsible for even the smallest bit of user-generated content on their site, and would have allowed ISPs, would have required ISPs to blacklist entire websites over tiny bits of potentially of copyrighted material posted by users. So that would have completely shifted the balance of power between between large copyright holders like the movie industry and the music industry and websites. We were able to rally large numbers of websites, defeat the bills, and that was kind of where Fight for the Future came on the scene. And since then, Fight for the Future has worked on privacy issues coming out of the Snowden revelations. It's worked on net neutrality in 2014 and 2015, passing net neutrality rules and then attempting to defend them, passing net neutrality rules in California that that are extremely significant for the whole country. And most recently, Fight for the Future has been really active on trying to limit the use of face recognition tech and other biometric surveillance in the United States especially. So that's Fight for the Future. And, you know, I think I grew up just being very interested both in technology and in politics and not politics in the kind of, you know, Washington sense, but politics in the sense of like how people come together to exert power and change the world in ways that are beneficial. And that joint interest in those two things kind of led me in two directions, both doing activism using the internet and also in the direction of building tools to give people more power in different ways. And so Fight for the Future is an example of my work on the activism side, and Quiet is an example of my work on the software side.
Quiet, in a way, is an alternative to Slack and Discord and other proprietary corporation-run ways of helping people to talk to each other. And I'm already using it. Thank you for getting me going on that. So tell us a little bit about what's wrong with, I mean, in the sense of privacy and everything else that we value, about having all of our chat and all of our messaging and all of our collaborative conversation inside corporate silos, and why this is a better approach.
So there's a few serious problems with apps like Slack and Discord, some of which are mitigated by free software alternatives now, and others of which I don't think are yet. The biggest problem for organizations and teams and companies using products like Slack and Discord is the problem of potential eventual breaches. We went through this as Fight for the Future, where on one of the campaigns we were working on, it was actually our campaign on defending net neutrality rules. We became subject to a fairly sophisticated phishing attack. And it was pretty clear from the outset that the goals of the attacker were to try to get access to our internal communications. And this is a common tactic that's used against political and civil society organizations and sometimes political campaigns to try to disrupt them or discredit them or sort of shift the balance between them and their adversaries. They try to get access to all your internal comms, spit them onto the internet somewhere, and then start leaking, you know, potentially juicy tidbits where, you know, an employee was saying something indiscreet about a coworker or an allied organization, or where somebody has said something that can be made to sound insincere or devious in some way, and sort of throwing that all out onto the internet and then doing strategic leaking around it in order to discredit you with policymakers, or tie up your time, or just disrupt your internal organizational harmony or relationships with other organizations. We became subject to that attack. And the issue with tools like Slack is that we were essentially trusting that data to Slack. So even if we, in responding to the phishing attack, we were already set up with two-factor authentication and our different processes for making sure that our accounts are secure, they didn't end up actually getting anything. But the scary thing about it was that Slack at some point could suffer a global breach where the data of many different organizations could be spilled out onto the internet in one moment. And that could happen at any time over the next 10 years. That could happen for any number of reasons. And it could be, in that moment, devastating to a broad class of organizations, because it would give their attackers potentially years of messages to go through just looking for stuff to use against them. And, you know, with someone, I was talking to one person in the security space about this and who said that there's two types of organizations that have had all of their internal communications spilled out onto the internet and had that experience of how bad it is, and organizations that have not. Organizations that have had that happen to them, or who have faced the prospect of that possibly happening as we did, take a completely different perspective on this stuff. When you go through that, you never want it to happen again. And when you face the possibility of it happening, you want to take every step possible to make sure it doesn't happen again. So the biggest issue with Slack and Discord in particular is that they are sitting on massive troves of internal communications, and all it takes is one mistake for all of that to be spilled out onto the internet in the clear.
So I think you sort of started going in this direction, but what I'm wondering is if you could go into a little bit more detail about why you took the route that you did, making this a decentralized app over Tor to do your messaging, as opposed to, I mean, there are other open source messaging alternatives like Matrix or taking an approach like Signal. So what,
Yeah.
Why did you choose to take this, you know, this path that you did?
So there's the most common approach to solving this problem of, well, what if the server is hacked and what if there's a breach, and making sure that messages are protected is to encrypt messages on the client side. So if you use end-to-end encryption, in apps like Signal, Matrix, and possibly, although nobody knows, but at least they say WhatsApp is doing that too. When you take that approach, you are you're making it so that the server doesn't have access to the messages, and so that in a breach, the contents would not be revealed. However, there are other types of privacy. There are other types of privacy breaches that approach wouldn't or isn't adequate to protect against, and where you need to do other things. So the hardest thing to protect in the centralized messaging app and the approach that centralized messaging apps take is who is talking to who. In Signal's case, they try to forget it as quickly as possible. So when you send a message to someone else in Signal, that Signal is sort of actively trying to to forget, to remove messages as soon as they're delivered. But there are some limits as to how quickly or in what cases they can do that. And at some point in the process, they need to know that that I'm sending a message to you, and that Signal needs to be aware of that in order to deliver the message appropriately. And if Signal is aware of it, that means that potentially their service provider, Amazon, is aware of it. And if they're aware of it, they could be hacked, and someone could get persistent presence on their servers and, you know, track who is talking to who. Or someone could potentially do that on the Amazon layer, or there are a bunch of ways that information can leak out. That metadata about who is talking to who is very, very hard to protect in a centralized approach. But in a decentralized approach, it can be easier to protect, or you can get to a higher level of protection for that. So what the approach Quiet takes is, instead of storing messages on a central server, and instead of creating a situation where we need to know who is talking to who in order to deliver messages correctly, instead we give users an app where over Tor, all the devices that they're using can connect to the devices of other people in their team or organization or community, and deliver a message directly between those devices. So messages are not delivered to us. We have no knowledge of who is, we have no way of knowing who is speaking with who. And actually, if because of the way that Tor works, it would be quite, someone would need, protecting that metadata as part of Tor's threat model. And so while there are potential attacks at Tor that someone could use, or potential attacks on the Tor network that someone could use to get access to that data about who is talking to who in some cases, those attacks are, or Tor has the power to make those attacks very complicated and expensive and inaccessible to most attackers. So there is a, in the approach that we take, in the decentralized approach that we take, we're able to protect metadata about who is talking to who, to a fairly high degree. But I think there's decentralization gives another class of benefits, which is that, which relate more to the software freedom of the user. When you're using an app like Signal, the app itself is free and open source software. But if you wanted to change something fundamental about how the app worked and wanted to fork it, it would be somewhat, Signal is still running the server infrastructure that the app depends on. And they, you know, there's a complicated question about whether they would allow you to use their servers to deliver messages. And so a fork of Signal might end up not interoperating with Signal. And ultimately, a fork of Signal cannot change or propose to change what Signal does on their server side, of course, because they're their servers, they're running the code. So even in an app like Signal that is run by a nonprofit, that's free and open source software, the central server model limits how much freedom users have. And when you move to a case like Matrix, where it's even a bit more decentralized than Signal, where anyone can run their own Matrix server, even there, from a user standpoint, a user either needs to bring their own server, have a friend who has a server, or trust the default server provided. And you still end up, the user still ends up in a situation where they don't, in most cases, have any type of meaningful control over what the server is doing. And so any things that are left up to the server, like account identity or metadata protection, are still in the hands of somebody else. Whereas if you go all the way and build an app, if you go all the way to decentralization and build an app where there is no central server required, where the app itself contains its own ability to communicate with other apps, and that's it, any software freedom guarantees that the user gets by being able to download the app, inspect the source code, understand it, change it, and all these things the four freedoms that are important to free software, all of those things are completely guaranteed and not dependent on whether the user can bring their own server and deploy and maintain a server. So you get these really, really nice software freedom properties with peer-to-peer decentralized apps. And that's the thing of all of this stuff. That's the thing that I'm the most excited about. Not only can you push the envelope in terms of the privacy properties you're able to provide, but you can also completely change the relationship of power between the end user and the software maker by giving the user complete software freedom that does not depend on infrastructure run by the software maker.
That's really interesting. I hadn't considered the sort of empowerment of making something like that a little bit more approachable by eliminating the need for a server. I wondered if we could take a little bit of a step back and talk about identity for just a minute, because there are a lot of conversations right now about authenticating users and eliminating bot users. We've all followed, I'm sure, the Elon Musk Twitter conversation. But I wondered if you could kind of talk about how you feel about the importance of anonymity and not necessarily being able to be identified. I think there's a thought that people need to be held accountable or something like that. But as an activist, I thought maybe you could talk about the true value of anonymity a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think there's, when I was, I think 20 or 21, 9/11 happened. And coming out of that, there was this like, it was a really rough patch in American civic life where any type of assertion of the importance of privacy or the importance of civil liberties was immediately kind of, people would kind of turn around and point to you and say, well, what about catching terrorists?
Right.
And so I think there's always that tension, and we know we need to try to catch and stop people who are trying to kill lots of their fellow people. And we also know that we need privacy and civil liberties for democracies to function and to build places that, where many people can share the same land or the same planet together. And so I think, the tension there in practice, I think, is resolved. And, and this comes up for terrorism. It comes up for other issues like online harassment. The tension in practice is resolved by the observation that, there's always things you can do to try to catch a terrorist that are not impeded by privacy and civil liberties. And there's always ways you can expand privacy and civil liberties that do not make it impossible to catch a terrorist. So I think the role of people whose job it is to catch terrorists is to catch terrorists. And the role of people whose job it is to expand privacy and civil liberties is to expand privacy and civil liberties. And the way we've structured our society is that those different roles and those different institutions will kind of, both try to do their thing and balance each other out. And sometimes they come to loggerheads. And, one of the issues I worked on at Fight for the Future was when the FBI wanted to get access to a terrorist's iPhone and or to data on a terrorist's iPhone, and the FBI said to Apple, hey, give us a backdoor to this iPhone. And Apple said no. And the FBI said, so you're supporting terrorism with these devious full disk encryption, you know, tools you offer users. And at Fight for the Future, we said, no, they're not. They're doing exactly what they should be doing. Their users want privacy. They're doing the only thing they can do to prevent or to protect the billions of users that that could get their phone stolen, for example, from those thieves, you know, using that data in ways that would be terrible. And this is exactly what they should do. And the FBI should just try to do its thing and figure out what it can do with to get this data, or figure out what it can do to protect people without having access to this data. Because Apple's role is to protect the privacy of its users, not to help the government spy. So we came out with that, and we actually ran protests at Apple stores around the country saying that Apple was doing the right thing. I'm not a big fan of Apple, the company, myself, but that in that moment they were doing the right thing, and that it was a really important debate to have, and we wanted to make sure that the public was weighing in on that debate in a meaningful way. So there are moments where this comes up in tension, and the way society and democracy is supposed to work is that these different institutions kind of push in different directions. And when they need to have a public fight about it, we have that debate and we all make our case, and policymakers decide who to listen to. And so far the movement that, you know, that I'm part of, that organizations like EFF, were instrumental in starting, has been very successful in protecting encryption rights in the US and in Europe and in many countries, although it continues to be a huge issue. So in anything, you know, your original question was about anonymity. I think anonymity is the same thing. The reason why we need privacy is because sometimes society needs you to be able to say what you really think without fear of judgment. That is how progress happens. Society needs to be able to say what you think and potentially even do what you think without fear of judgment, if that's possible to achieve. This is the privacy has made it possible in cases where society was wrong about something for people to ignore society's rules in private, build critical mass, and then come out on the scene and say, hey, look, we've been doing this all along. It's not really that scary or that threatening. Society needs to change its rules. That's happened with rights for LGBTQ plus folks. That's happened with legalization of some, and hopefully most drugs, or decriminalization. And it's been possible because we have, for example, in our homes, some practical, at least, and potentially legal right to privacy, where experimentation with a new way of doing things can happen, or a different way of doing things than what society thinks it wants to allow can happen without really hurting anyone or freaking anyone out or creating judgment and creating backlash from society. And because people have those free spaces where they can experiment, they can innovate beyond the bounds set by society in a way that isn't harmful to society. And that type of innovation is... And when I say innovation in that case, I'm not talking about like tech innovation. I'm just talking about like people finding new ways of living and new ways of doing things. Right, sure. That type of innovation and growth can happen in a way that's really harmonious with other social needs like public order and stuff like that. You know, you're not out in the street freaking everyone out and breaking the rules and making everyone feel like the sky's falling. You have the privacy of your own home to experiment. And I think on the internet, the risk is that because you know, of the intense copyability of digital technology, because of the abysmal state of security, that we might end up in a situation where in this new space, where we're actually living a lot of our lives now, where we're, you know, talking about politics, where we're dating, where we're meeting with the groups that we're a part of, that all of a sudden, because of the danger is that because of just the characteristics of digital technology, maybe some quirks in the law or the failure of the law to really keep up, we lose a lot of the privacy that we enjoyed in our physical spaces. And I think the big battle here is to ensure that we keep those things. And anonymity is just part of that. I mean, I don't think you always need to be anonymous in order to say what you think, but some people definitely do sometimes. And society benefits from that because, you know, you... society functions the best when it's able to integrate the maximal number of perspectives from well-intentioned and sincere participants.
I like it. Yeah, I think it's useful to remind people that, or to remember ourselves, that democracy itself was once a radical idea that was talked through in private spaces. I think Doc has a question now.
Right. So we have a pretty geeky show here. And I want to ask some questions and get us talking about exactly how Quiet works. It's at 0.5 right now. What gets us to 1.0? Stuff like that. But first, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by New Relic. If you're a software engineer, you've been there, it's 9 p.m., you're finally unwinding from work, your phone buzzes with an alert, something's broken, and your mind is already racing at what could be wrong. Is it the back end or the front end? Is it global? Is it the server? Is it the network? Is it the cloud provider? Do we have a slow-running query thing going on? Did I introduce a bug in my last deploy? Now the whole team's scrambling from tool to tool and messaging person after person to find and fix the issue. According to a New Relic report, over half of all organizations are implementing observability for their networks and systems. The report shows how maintaining network observability continues to be an issue for most companies around the world. That won't happen if you get New Relic. New Relic combines 16 different monitoring products that you'd normally buy separately so engineering teams can see across their entire software stack in one place. You'll get application monitoring, that's APM, unified monitoring for your apps and microservices, Kubernetes and Pixie, instant Kubernetes observability with Pixie, distributed tracing, see all your traces without management headaches so you can find and fix issues fast, network performance monitoring, stop guessing where performance issues start and ditch data silos for a system-wide correlated view, and so much more. More importantly, you can pinpoint issues down to the line of code so you know exactly why the problem happened and can resolve it quickly. That's why the dev and ops teams at DoorDash, GitHub, Epic Games, and more than 14,000 other companies use New Relic to debug and improve their software. Whether you run a cloud-native startup or a Fortune 500 company, it takes just 5 minutes to set up New Relic in your environment. That next 9 p.m. call is just waiting to happen. Get New Relic before it does, and you can get access to the whole New Relic platform at 100 gigabytes of data free per month forever, no credit card required. Sign up at newrelic.com/floss. That's newrelic.com/floss. newrelic.com/floss. Okay, so Holmes, I notice I'm using Quiet here. It was easy to install. According to the thing there, you're at 0.5. It's called 0.5 alpha. At some point you get to 1.0. What's between here and there, and take us down a level or two into what design choices you made. I know you said you're using Tor. There's CRTC, C something, four letters.
CRDT,
which is a thing that's part of IPFS, I think, or maybe it's not. You're using IPFS also, right?
Yeah.
So put those pieces together for us a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the goal is to build something that a group of people can use every day as their as their main collaboration space, as a substitute for Slack or Discord. That means supporting most platforms. That means, you know, Mac, Windows, and most desktop platforms, Mac, Windows, and Linux. That means supporting mobile as well, iOS and Android. The desktop app is in a form that people can try it out now. It's not in a form that's recommended to be used for folks requiring security because it hasn't been audited yet. But we use it all the time internally. And yeah, me and Doc are using it right now. so I'll send a message. I just said, hi, Doc. On the mobile side, where we're at is we have proofs of concept. on Android and on iOS of an Android or iOS app that can connect to Tor and sync messages with other quiet desktop clients and send messages. And but we don't have polished mobile apps yet. So that's definitely going to be necessary. The other piece of this is that there's a long list of features that people have come to expect from this class of app. It should be able to send images and files. We should be able to have, emoji reactions. We should be able to at mention people and have granular notification settings.
I'm screen sharing right now. I don't know if John's pulling that up or not, but because I have a small screen, I'm looking at too many things. But you can see how it looks. It actually looks a lot like other really simple, straightforward systems like that. Like one Slack channel, for example, and you have a hashtag and general some specific ones that people set up. But it's design wise, it looks very familiar. There's no learning curve involved at all. It seems to me.
Yeah, that's our goal. And we focused a lot on the process of inviting users and joining. And that could be still made a lot smoother, but right now it's pretty nice. You share essentially an invite code with someone via a secure channel like Signal, and they paste that code into the app, and then they can join the community with that. They pick a username. Everyone has real usernames. The question before about identity, what we're doing for identity is not having global identity, but instead having identity that's relative to the community that you join. So each time you join a new community in Quiet, and you'll be able to join multiple ones in the future, although it just works with one now, you pick a name, and that identity is granted to you by the person who started the community, or maybe in the future by an admin. And we use just a standard public key infrastructure certificate signing process for that. And it works quite well. So you have some pretty strong guarantees of unique and non-impersonatable usernames, which is a thing that most peer-to-peer kind of prototypey peer-to-peer chat apps don't usually do. But is a thing that people are pretty, that makes the app very familiar. So we're working down this long list of features, like, sending images. And then once we do that, we can let people have an avatar image. And we can let people send files or send audio messages or all that stuff. And there's a lot of just very front-endy features that we need to do. Just getting the basic underlying peer-to-peer stack working is a lot. And it's what we've been focused on up to this point. But we're at a point now where it's pretty reliable. So the stack on desktop is we use Electron for the sort of cross-platform UI tool, and everything else is JavaScript. We use except for Tor. So going from the bottom up, there's Tor, which is what connects you to, which is the sort of final thing that connects you out to other clients, and all connections go over Tor. You just don't touch the internet unless it goes through Tor. And then on top of that, there's libp2p, which is part of the IPFS project, which handles things like maintaining connections to peers, gossiping, it handles things like maintaining connections to peers. And then on top of that, there's the rest of the IPFS stack, where you have a broadcast functionality that can kind of send up where a message gets sent out to the peers you're connected to, and they pass it on to the peers they're connected to, with an algorithm that ensures that probably everyone who's online in that moment is going to see that. And then there's a kind of BitTorrent-like piece of IPFS where you can fetch data from other peers and kind of ask other peers who's got what blocks and pull it all down. And then all of this is wrapped together by a tool that's called OrbitDB. That is a CRDT built on IPFS, and a CRDT is, the shortest explanation would be that it's a machine for decentralized syncing. So if a CRDT solves the problem of what happens if there's lots of different data coming in from different apps in a decentralized, or different clients in a decentralized network that want to sync to each other, and how do you make sure that everyone ends up eventually with the same copy of the data. So in this case, our data is messages or, you know, attachments to messages or channel, the channel list or the user list. In other applications, the data could be something like a shared document that multiple people are editing or a shared database, a spreadsheet or something like that. It's pretty agnostic as to what kind of data it is. A CRDT just guarantees that for certain for some set of invariants, you can get an eventual consistency between all the different clients in the network. So that's basically how the app works. There's a initial bootstrapping process where you get an invitation link or an invitation code to join, which is a Tor Onion address. You use that to connect to the first person in the network. Then you get kind of fully added to the network and given the full set of peers in the network or all their addresses and their key information. And then your app, or once we have it on mobile, the apps, you know, your apps or your clients are kind of voraciously connecting to other clients in the network and trying to sync the current state of the network as fast as they can. That's pretty much how it works.
So there's something you said earlier that I really like. And in fact, I sent it, I've already put it in another chat that I'm in. The central server model limits how much freedom people have. And I was thinking, okay, I don't have a dog. My sister does. And she's become friends with all the other people who have dogs at the dog park. And they're becoming very social. They'd like to talk about how to improve the dog park, whatever it might be. If they'd like to set something up and don't want it, I mean, Slack is actually a fairly heavy duty way to do that. Even Discord is. And it seems to me what you've got here is something that maps much better to the real world. We don't need a server in order to communicate with each other in the real world. We don't, we just talk and we become social in an essentially peer to peer way. But the socialness of peer to peer arises out of people collaborating and in some cooperative way. It's an emergent property. And it strikes me that what you're working on here, starting with a peer-to-peer idea, you're really much more internet native and much less web native or even app native, even though you can do something in a browser. You can use it in an app on a phone, but it's a peer app. It's not a client app. You can call it a client. You can call yourself a user, but basically you're independent. You're free [S2] Yeah. [S1] as a human being, which is not just a user, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It maps really well to human groups or associations that are bounded in some way. So what's exciting about this is I actually think we've discovered is maybe too strong a word, but sort of settled into a mode of making applications for communication and collaboration that is general to all the cases where you have a group of people that has its members and some, you know, system for adding and removing people. And they are working on something together. And maybe they don't all have access to all the same stuff, but they're generally sort of participating together in some type of activity. That's the approach that we've chosen can work for all those cases. So you could use the approach that we've taken to build something like Google Docs or something like Google Sheets or something like a team password sharing app or something like a Kanban, you know, to-do list tracking board for your team, or for your community group. Peer-to-peer apps, right, in the current state of peer-to-peer tech are actually pretty good at that. Although, you know, there's some work to put all the pieces together, but those kinds of apps are, peer-to-peer is really good at. The things that are really hard for peer-to-peer apps to do are things like sharing lots of data in a global network in complex ways, in a global open network in complex ways. So building something like Twitter or Facebook would be very difficult now with a peer-to-peer app because you don't have these sort of circles with defined membership. Instead, everything's kind of bleeding into everything else. And then you start to have significant issues with spam. And some of the tech from the blockchain and cryptocurrency space begins to answer some of those questions. But, you know, as they say in that space, it's still early days, and there aren't like very strong primitives that are really performant that you can use to, you know, address things like identity and spam in a fully decentralized way in a global open network yet. So there's a reason why we chose to make a team chat app like Slack or Discord instead of a big social networking app like Facebook. I think you're right. It sort of does the one way of thinking about why is that the structure of the app and the network map really well to the human like relationship structures. So I like that perspective on it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, back when I became aware of and then enamored by and then in awe of the internet itself in the 80s and then especially in the mid 90s when it took off was that the peer-to-peer promise is suddenly like, hey, all of us are now zero distance apart at almost no cost. That's cool. What could be done with that? And almost all of our cyber utopianism back then was around what all of us could do as individuals in collaboration rather than let's start a company and sell stuff, you know, or any of that. And it's not to knock it, you know, knock the client server model. We wouldn't be here without it. But the client server model is left over from the mainframe age. There's the internet itself is inherently peer to peer. For that matter, so is the web. I mean, even HTTP is just, I'm looking at a document on somebody else's server. That doesn't mean that it has to be stored in a highly centralized way. So it seems like there's some pioneering stuff going on there. But I'm wondering too, how this, you've made a choice to do this with Tor, which to me makes complete sense. Does Tor hold up as you expand? I don't know. I don't have a sense of that.
Well, so the really cool thing about Tor is it almost gives you, people think about Tor as, you know, being like for, you know, intense anonymity and privacy and the darknet and stuff like that. But actually one kind of less noticed thing about Tor is it gives you almost like an abstraction layer that's like the internet as it should be. Like when you use Tor onion services, you have an address on the internet that is forever. And that wherever you go moves with you. And you also have a way of connecting to arbitrary peers that is always going to work. Or, you know, unless Tor fails or unless you can't connect to Tor, is always going to work. And, Tor's job is to make it so as many people in the world can connect to Tor, even when their governments or networks really don't want them to. So, so pretty much if you can have a video call with an arbitrary person, you can connect to Tor. And so with Tor, you get this almost like ideal situation that the internet itself doesn't actually provide. Like when two peers try to connect to each other over the regular internet, a lot of the time they need the help of another server to do hole punching because one of them is behind a router, they're both behind routers. And then sometimes they need even more than that. Sometimes they just need another server to relay the whole connection. And this comes up in video calls where I think it's something like 18% of pairs of people on the internet when they make a video call tend to need the help of a full relay of all data through a centralized server just because of their network context and not being able to make a direct connection between each other. But Tor just like solves that for us. And it's really, really helpful for small networks. Like you don't notice this problem with peer-to-peer networks that are big, like BitTorrent, because if you know there's 100 people downloading a file, you only need to be able to connect to a few of them. And if you can't connect to all of them, that's fine. It still works. So peers can kind of find the easy peers to connect to and connect to them. But in a group of people that are trying to communicate, you know, there might be a group of just five of us. And if two people can't make a connection, that's a pretty big problem. So that's what's cool about Tor. And then in terms of how it scales, I think Tor is trying to scale as much as they can. And Tor becomes stronger and more anonymous and more private the more people use it. That's a cool thing about anonymity tools like, there's a classic case of a Tor user who was actually doing something pretty, but there's a classic case of a Tor user on a college campus getting de-anonymized because, the campus network admin just looked up and said, you know, who was using Tor at this time and this day on our campus. And it turned out it was like this person and a couple other people. So if not many people are using Tor in the network that you're in the city that you're in at a given moment, you're not that anonymous on Tor. So Tor really, really benefits the more people use Tor. So up to a certain point, I think, you know, if 1 million people start using Quiet or 10 million people start using Quiet, I think that's a great problem for the Tor network to have, because they'll have a much larger anonymity set at every sort of granular level. And anonymity set is that idea of like how many people are using the anonymity tool and how many people you're kind of indistinguishably mixed between. If we start growing faster than Tor can grow, I mean, the options would be to for us to help invest in Tor to make it so it can grow faster, or for us to, you know, figure out some way to work without Tor, which would either involve centralization or building something of our own that was like Tor. I think the path there is pretty clear, and all of it's kind of in the problems in the bucket of good problems to have. I think if there's a long period where the Tor network isn't reliable, that would, you know, and we're not able to quickly transition to another thing, that would be a problem for us. But we're so far from that at this point that, you know, I would cross that bridge when we come to it.
So given what you just said about being easier to hide in a larger crowd, I think, or at least that's my paraphrasing. So where you are in the stage of the project is you're not quite there yet, right? And that potentially means that, you know, the security hardening isn't where you would like it to be. And it's maybe not the ideal tool yet to protect your privacy for those reasons. Where do you need to go from here? And, you know, and while you have an audience, a pretty decent audience of fairly tech savvy people, you know, what are the things that you're looking for in terms of feedback and in order to make it that really solid app that it needs to be ultimately?
Yeah. So there are sources of grants for projects like ours to get audits. It's something that we might be able to fund ourselves. And that's definitely on our list of things to do. We're also looking at like what major pieces of our stack have been audited. And there's one, the CRDT piece of our stack is a bit newer, and we might end up working with them to try to get them funding to get an audit, but that seems doable too. So that's definitely something that's on our roadmap, and we'll get to it when we get to it. The most important thing we need now, though, are early adopters who can give us a sense of what we should be building and what we should be focusing on. Because, you know, if we just set out to make a carbon copy of Slack, we might be able to do that in 10 years. But, you know, in the meantime, Slack will have moved on. Slack has a lot of features, and Discord also has a lot of features. I don't think we're going to succeed by just making a, by just sort of setting out to make a clone of some other thing. I think we need to find a group of people who really, we need to find teams and organizations and communities or groups that really want, either for principled reasons, to use a tool that gives them this degree of software freedom, or to use a tool that where they're not dependent on any servers run by others, or where they need privacy properties, and where the user experience of Signal or Matrix just isn't really cutting it for them. And where they're able to evaluate, you know, where we're at pre-audit as a privacy tool, where they have a degree of sophistication where they can kind of make that assessment in-house. And or where they're, you know, maybe not using this for its privacy guarantees, but where they're you know, they think it's cool and want to try it out and help. We're looking for a few groups like that who we can engage with regularly, who are like using the app regularly, who we can get feedback from. And, you know, if folks say we need such and such feature, we'll try to build that as quickly as we can, exactly as they need it. I'm looking for maybe 3 or 5 groups to be those initial users. And so far the way that's gone is just reaching out to groups in my circle and saying, hey, I've got this thing. It's pretty cool. Do you want to see it and try it out? And just do a kind of one-off quick test with it for anyone in their team who's interested, and then start the conversation about, okay, what would this need to have for you to use it regularly? What uses could you find for it? Are there any gaps in your current workflow that like this might be able to address if we added certain features? Asking questions like that and then just following up from there. So if there's anyone out there who wants to, or who either is part of a group that might want to use this or is or knows of someone who is, I would love to get your feedback. And I'm also really interested in feedback on our design and our overall approach from security experts, especially security experts who are often in a position of recommending tools to other groups. That's also a type of person who would be really helpful at this stage. Not like, you know, so you can do a whole audit of our code for free, although that'd be awesome if anybody wanted to do that. But that's, you know, I'm really just looking for folks to kind of look at it and give us their take, you know, on their basic kind of sniff test of things we should be looking at and worried about and ask questions and see if we have adequate answers to those questions. So yeah, the two things I'm looking for are early adopter teams and security experts who sometimes recommend things to such teams or are in a position of recommending tech to such teams who can kind of look at our thing, poke at its inadequacies and ask questions and see if our answers are adequate.
Yeah, that sounds great. As an end user, a potential end user, let's say, I want to use it today. What are the biggest limitations? I mean, what is the risk of using it today as an early adopter?
We've put a lot of work over the past half year or so or year into having a pretty robust like automated testing setup. So we have automated tests for all the basic things like a user can join a community, users can send messages, users can see each other's stuff. So this stuff, all that main stuff, really, all the stuff that it says it does right now, it actually does pretty well. So you can, you know, create a community, create channels, join, like register usernames, send messages, and correspond, as Duck and I were sort of doing a second ago in the app. That all that works. And another thing that works that's really cool is if you go offline, when you connect to peers again, you'll sync the messages that were sent while you were gone. So you can usually see messages sent while you were offline, which is really cool. And the things it doesn't do that we miss the most are we keep a list of like all the reasons why we switch back to Slack ourselves while we're dogfooding, while we're like using Quiet internally. And the big ones are doesn't send images. The number one is we don't have DMs yet, but we're going to add them. It's straightforward, but we just don't have it yet. So no DMs, no sending and receiving images or files, no like online status. Like it's hard. There's no way to see when your other members are online with short of them just sending a message or you kind of pinging them. And there's no, you know, at mentions or granular notifications. So your notifications are either on or off, and that's not really that great most of the time, especially if you're in a team of more than a handful of people. So then there's a longer list of things that we missed, like fun stuff like reactions, or which actually people miss quite a bit, and are really useful. And then typing indicators, you know, to let you know someone's typing a message. There's a bunch of like very basic stuff that messaging apps do, pretty much all of them do really well, that we don't do yet. And you'll miss all that stuff. So that's pretty much where things are. And then the biggest one, which I think is number four on our list of why we go back to using Slack, is mobile. And that ends up being a big thing because, like, you know, even in a team that's on their computers all the time, usually like there's a few people who are traveling a lot or in meetings. It's often like the managers of the team, they need it on their phones, and it's hard to get everyone to move if there isn't a mobile app. That's what's missing now. And then as far as the privacy and security properties go, the main thing that we haven't implemented yet is like disappearing messages and time deletion, but that's definitely a priority. And definitely something we're going to be really focused on is like, because that's a huge part of the privacy equation. Then there's some other more subtle questions on the privacy and security side of like, okay, say someone malicious does get into your community. Say you invite someone malicious into your community. How do you, how do you deal with that? And what are the, how do you try to maintain as many of the security properties as possible, even when there's someone in the community who could like do a denial of service attack on everybody or something like that? How do you mitigate some of those threats? And that gets into removing users. We've, you know, in our true to our sort of prototyping nature here, we've built a community you can add people to, but we haven't built a mechanism for removing people yet. And removal in a peer-to-peer network isn't, and doing that securely isn't trivial. So we haven't tackled that yet, but obviously we will. But right now, if you wanted to kick someone out, you basically just have to invite everybody again to a new space and burn down the old one. And that's not ideal. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff that's missing still.
Yeah. I hate to say we are pretty much at an hour here. And so we always close with a few quick questions, but the first one, if you could answer briefly, is there anything we haven't asked that you want to cover before we go off? That might have been on your head.
I think I touched on this before, but for folks who really care about software freedom, I think it's really worth envisioning or picturing a future where at least for the class of apps where we know how to do this, we cut the cord to servers and we start deploying free software apps that just work out of the box for complex collaboration between users without requiring that they trust someone else's server or have their own. Because users aren't going to bring their own server in most cases. So whenever you ship an app that requires a server, you're requiring them to trust somebody, and that undermines their software freedom. So I'd really urge everyone to think about how awesome it would be if we can build a movement to build apps like Quiet that perhaps do other things, but that enable people to collaborate in complex ways without trusting servers with free software.
That is great. So a final two, what are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Gosh.
We always ask those.
Let's see. So if I had to, I think for text editor, if I had to make something, I would use VS Code and JavaScript. I'm mostly a product manager. But I did how to design programs, which is like a Racket based course in 2015. And I got decent at front end stuff. So, you know, I would probably use some combination of Node and Vue and JavaScript, and I'd probably use VS Code right now. But yeah.
That's great. Well, it has been awesome having you on the show. And as Quiet matures, especially when you get to 1.0 and that laundry list you had of things that you want to add, grow, love to have you back on. We do have people back on the show. So this has been great.
Cool. Yeah. I hope we get there soon.
I do too. So thanks. So, so Catherine, yeah, thank you, man. So Catherine, did we cover enough? I don't, it, I felt last, oh gosh, this is the second time we've done this. And it's still,
I don't know.
It's still stuff.
I still think, yeah, there's much. I think that's the nature of a work in progress though, right? There's always going to be so much to talk about. I think I'm really anxious to try it out now, actually. I'm thinking of some ideas of groups that can.
We should play with it for, you know, because we're on a team together.
I think so too. I think, I loved that last answer, his answer to what, you know, he wanted to cover and maybe we didn't yet. That was, I'm going to go back when this is published. I'm going to write that down, print it out, and put it on my wall, I think. So it's really good advice.
Yeah,
because I think it's not something I always think about.
I think the Linux Journal piece that I point back to most often that has sadly aged the least, I think, is one that has the title, "If Your Privacy Is Up to Somebody Else, You Don't Have Any." And that's pretty much the
is
point.
Is that the one with the calf cow?
Yeah, that's one of the calf and the cow. Right. You're the calf. You go to the cow for the milk of whatever server gives you, you know, and it's and the cookies. It's milk and cookies.
Cookies. But that's so benign sounding.
Yeah, I mean, we do trust institutions. Institutions are important to have for lots of things, and we do want institutions to be centralized around what they do, but our personal freedom as members of society requires not that we have our own server, because it's still sort of in the same system. I think it was a really good point that Holmes made, but rather that you have a tool. You just, we all have mouths and larynxes, and we have tools for speaking. That makes us, it's one of the things that makes us human, and we can gesture and we can do all these things that are inherently personal. You don't get those as a service. You get those come with us as human beings. And we need the same kind of thing when we're online. What comes with us as human beings and not as members of something that has a record of us and at whose mercy we operate. There's something fundamentally not free about that. And that's an important distinction to remember. I really like it.
Yeah, I thought that was good.
Yeah. So any plugs?
I forgot about the plug thing. Yeah.
Well,
other podcast.
Yeah. So we have the Reality 2 cast that we have another interview with Holmes before this one. Well, I think we did a pretty good job of not treading on the same territory.
I think
that. So if people want the complete Holmes experience, you can go there.
Use Drupal. So, that's my other plug. You know, always use some Drupal in your life.
Yeah, you've got that in the background, and the Drupal little guy, the little blue guy behind those who can see you. So this has been great. Well, this has been another, it's been a wonderful Floss Weekly, everybody. And we will, next week, as always, I don't have queued up who we're going to have next week. So I'm always very prepared, except in this one sense.
It's a surprise.
It's a surprise. And then I always have to scroll down to where we are now. Oh, yeah, Andre Kudrow. We've had him on before. Only this time we're talking about retro computing and the demo scene and all that stuff. So it's not going to be a repeat of the last time we had him on, which is about a year ago. He's great. I think he's in Germany. And he'll talk about the scene with retro computing there. He's a great guy. I just saw him actually in the Bay Area not long ago. So anyway, highly, highly, highly recommend that. That's coming up next week. So until then, I'm Doc Searles. This is Floss Weekly. We'll see you then.
Did you spend a lot of money on your brand new smartphone and then you look at the pictures on Facebook and Instagram and you're like, what in the world happened to that photo? Yes, you have. I know. It happens to all of us. Well, you need to check out my show, Hands-On Photography, where I'm going to walk you through simple tips and tricks that are going to help make you get the most out of your smartphone camera or your DSLR or mirrorless, whatever you have. And those shots are going to look so much better. I promise you. So make sure you're tuning in to twit.tv/hop for Hands-On Photography to find out more.